You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 20th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to talk plutocrats. Who better than Chrystia Freeland, the author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we will be back live tomorrow, Friday, December 21st, for the final live program of 2012.
That's if there is a December 21st.
Yes, that is assuming that the people who misinterpreted the Mayan calendar were wrong and the world doesn't end. If the world does end, however, ladies and gentlemen, this would be your last opportunity to become a Majority Report member. And also, it would be a huge savings for you because you could spend the rest of today going back to all the past archives, listening to all the shows, and then never have to pay a subscription fee again. It's a little bit late for you, obviously, to get justcoffee.coop, because by the time it got shipped to you, the world would have been over. And I don't know where they would deliver it to. They would probably also have problems delivering it. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back live tomorrow. But enjoy this interview that you have never heard before, right after this brief message. Folks, a quick reminder, this month the Majority Report is being sponsored by a great company which uses 1% of their revenue to fund progressive nonprofits and even more of their revenue to fund progressive political action. I'm talking about Credo Mobile, the only progressive cell phone company in the entire universe, I don't know. They're a great sponsor because, like the Majority Report, their politics are not funded by any one funder who dictates the positions they take. So they fight regressive establishment and right-wing policies without kowtowing. Credo Mobile is offering Majority Report listeners a great deal. 40% off all your first-year voice fees, true unlimited data, and a $350 credit against any cost you have in getting out of your contract with the other guys who happen to fund Republican candidates and agitate for Tea Party values. Go to credomobile.com/majority right now to get this deal before it ends on December 31st. That's credomobile.com/majority. Get yourself a great phone, get yourself a company that is agitating for your values, and help this show out. CredoMobile.com/majority.
To the imitation zone. Forget it, brother. You can go it alone. London calling to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't want to shout. But while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see, we ain't got no hide. Except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The sun's zooming in, engines stuck on it. The wheat is going thick, a nuclear error.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Chrystia Freeland. She is the digital editor of Thomson Reuters and the author of the recently released Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich, and and the Fall of Everyone Else. Welcome back to the program, Chrystia.
It is great to be with you.
So, all right, let's talk about the interesting thing about your book is it talks about plutocrats and contextualizes them both, I guess, temporally and geographically. In fact, we're talking about a global phenomenon.
Absolutely. And that was one of the really key points I wanted to make, and something that inevitably gets lost in the American discourse, and actually, interestingly, in the discussion of this in most countries. You know, people, the plutocracy is global, but media is still pretty national, and the middle class is still pretty national. So we tend to see our own national plutocrats, but not be as aware that this is not a local phenomenon, but a global one. And, you know, what we are seeing, my reporting found, is, you know, because of these economic forces of globalization, of the technology revolution, and also a shift in the political weather in a lot of countries, is the rise of this global superclass. It's not even just the 1%. It's sort of the 0.1% or the 0.01%. And, you know, they are becoming this trans-global community of peers. They do business with each other. They hang out with each other. They have homes in multiple locations, often in the same fancy buildings. And they have less and less to do with the middle class back home.
So, I mean, are the reasons for the growth of plutocrats, I mean, while it's happening globally, are the reasons the same, though? I mean, are there different dynamics that account for it in different countries?
The big drivers are really common. And so those big drivers are, first of all, the technology revolution, and that obviously is having an impact in technology, but it's having an impact on a lot of other industries as well. You know, it's had a big impact in financial services. It's having a big impact, you know, even in things like retail. You know, the story of Walmart is partly a story of the technology revolution. It's partly the story of globalization, and globalization is the source of fortunes in the West, but also obviously fortunes in the emerging markets. And then there is a political aspect to it. You know, really since the late 70s, early 80s, that sort of Reagan-Thatcher era, there has been this wave of a sort of, you know, a neoliberal economic philosophy that we've seen really sweeping a lot of the world, becoming more powerful following the collapse of communism and, you know, with the real invalidation of that alternative economic model, to which, by the way, I say, thank goodness. I think, you know, communism was terrible. And actually, I even lived in the Soviet Union as a journalist and student, so I know a little bit what I'm talking about. But, you know, that brought with it this wave of trade liberalization, of privatization, of deregulation, and that has been the third important force building these super fortunes and really giving the capital flows and therefore the human beings who are surfing those capital flows a global character.
I wonder, too, if there is some type of sort of like almost like a feedback loop in a sense. I mean, because you're describing, and maybe we should also take a moment to discuss exactly sort of, you know, what the profile is of these people. But I wonder if the existence of, in other words, that there's like a critical mass. When you have a certain amount of global plutocrats, it begins to cocoon them even more, because you're describing, it seems to me, a demographic, you know, a very narrow demographic to be sure, but one that that doesn't have as much relationship to its national origins. Which can only happen if there's enough of them to sort of form that type of, you know, community, I guess, or you know, have themselves reflected back upon themselves.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. And there is a sort of a cultural, a sociological element here that, you know, it's a validation of those norms. And you do need enough people living in that space for that to happen. It does, you know, it is possible to live in this bubble where, you know, you say, one of them said to me, you know, London looks a lot like Shanghai, which looks a lot like New York nowadays. And you sort of step back and you say, actually, it doesn't really. But, you know, he went on to say, you know, you stay in the same hotels, you eat in the same restaurants. And, you know, from the point of view of someone who's flying in a private jet to these different cities, staying in the same luxury hotels. One of them said to me, you know, we are the people of the Four Seasons. So, you know, you stay in a Four Seasons hotel in every one of these cities. You eat in the Four Seasons restaurant. The world does look, you know, very homogeneous. It feels like, you know, there exists this country, this space, you know, called the plutocracy. Some Citigroup analysts a couple of years ago dubbed it the plutonomy. Mm-hmm. And yes, that, you know, it does exist. It has its own social norms and behaviors.
So give us a sense of just sort of what one of these plutocrats look like, because I think to a certain extent there's a perception that these people are have inherited all their wealth and that they're silver spoon aristocrats. But you describe people who are not necessarily of that ilk.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about all of this is, you know, that it. One of the questions I get asked a lot is, you know, why write about the rich? Haven't the rich always been with us? And that question used to bug me, but now I really welcome it because it gives me an opportunity to say two things. First of all, that the gap between the super rich and everybody else is much, much bigger than it has been, certainly in the lifetime of pretty much anyone who's alive today. And perhaps in human history, you know, some economists will argue that, you know, that super, super elite is wealthier relative to everybody else than any elite has been that we know about. So that's kind of remarkable.
So we're talking about kings to peasants, essentially.
Right. Well, we are the peasants.
Right.
But yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, think about it. There was an economist, a guy called Branko Milanović at the World Bank, who wrote a really interesting and actually quite fun economic paper. Yes, such things do exist, in which he set out to find the richest person who ever lived. And he studies the Roman patricians, and he studies the Renaissance princes, and he studies the robber barons. And he determines that according to his methodology, right, and that's a that's a hard thing,
right,
you know, to ascertain with absolute certainty, because how do you compare owning a slave with owning a private jet? But according to the methodology he devised, the richest person who ever lived is Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of amazing. But the other thing that's interesting, and, you know, this is sort of a challenge for the left. You know, the right doesn't really like to talk about income inequality. And if really pressed, the right will sort of say, well, it's the inevitable price of economic growth, or they'll make arguments about how actually if you look at something like consumption, there's less consumption inequality, all sorts of stuff like that, or else they like to divide the population into larger slices rather than looking at the 1% or the 0.1%. They like to look at the top 20% because then you don't see where the real gap is. But while the left is, you know, starting really to energetically talk about income inequality, as it should, what people on the left are less comfortable really facing is the fact that today's super fortunes, much more actually than the fortunes at the end of the Gilded Age, are actually earned by a group that an economist at Berkeley, who's one of the premier students of this phenomenon, Emmanuel Saez, he calls them the working rich. And that is really a characteristic. Now, I don't want to lean on this point too much.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wish to become a plutocrat, it is wise to begin by being born into an affluent family. But having said that,
I will keep that in mind.
Yeah, exactly. We should all think about that. So, you know, it's not, you know, I'm not saying, you know, these are all guys born in the gutter, but, you know, thinking about someone like Mitt Romney is illustrative here. So he certainly, you know, his family, certainly by the time, you know, he was an adolescent, went to college, his family was an affluent family. Having said that, you know, he is a member of this working rich group. He did, you know, to use that meme from the election campaign, he did build it himself. He didn't inherit Bain Capital, he built it. And that is a very common characteristic of these super rich. They didn't inherit, or if they inherited, it was quite a small thing, which they then built into this, you know, super fortune.
I got to say, I think that, you know, that a guy like Leon Cooperman, who you wrote about in the New Yorker, is in some ways more illustrative of that. I mean, to the extent that, like, you know.
I use the Mitt Romney example just to point out that they don't all have.
He wasn't born with $240 million, but he did have an easier path to get there, I think, than most. I would imagine that the vast majority of governors' children or car company presidents' children are doing, you know, better. Now, $240 million or, you know, if or however much Romney has is probably also more on that scale. But I think you're right. I mean, at least in the sense that this is not the sort of the old money, I guess, is really the way to talk about it. Right. I mean, this is new money.
Right. This isn't, and that it shapes the worldview very much. This is not the world of Downton Abbey. This isn't, you know, in Britain there was this line that, you know, someone was nouveau and therefore sneered upon if he had to buy his own furniture,
right?
Because you were supposed to be an aristocrat who inherited it. This is not that world. This is people who buy their own furniture and are quite proud of doing so. In fact, if anything, there's maybe an exaggeration of the extent to which, you know, one pulled oneself up by one's own bootstraps. And that combination of being a member of the working rich, you know, feeling that you built it yourself, not having inherited it, and at the same time, the gap between the super rich and everybody else being so much bigger than it has been before, creates this very complex relationship between this super elite, between the plutocrats and the rest of us. You know, the economic chasm looms wider than ever, but in some ways, you know, there's a sense, first of all, that actually they really still are like us. You know, they self-identify in a way as being middle class. Mm-hmm. And you have that particularly, you know, from the culture of Silicon Valley, where, you know, Eric Schmidt put it to me quite nicely. He said, you know, it's simply not done to have a driver, but of course you can have a private jet. So it's that sort of real schizophrenia that, you know, you don't have a driver, you have these open offices, you have everybody wearing the same clothes, but actually the economic gap is bigger than ever. There was another sort of comment by Bill Gates that I found very revealing of that, where in 2010 he gave a speech at MIT and a brave student asked him what it was like to be a billionaire. And Bill Gates said, oh, you know, after the first few million, it doesn't make that much of a difference. It's just about how you can give back. And after all, a Big Mac costs the same amount of money, no matter how rich you are. So that sense that there really isn't such a big difference. On the other hand, the economic power, the economic distance is more vast than ever before. And I also found, and this was something I found really surprising, a certain, you know, definitely a cultural distance, an unnoted cultural distance, and also, again, an almost unconscious disdain among the super rich for the rest of us.
You know, I mean, it's interesting because it's almost as if on some level the perception or the reality that these people, and we're talking mostly men, that they, because they have built their own wealth on some level, it makes them more self-righteous about it in some ways. I mean,
exactly right. Yeah, feel superior. I mean, you know, my favorite, most explicit comment about this, and I say my favorite because I felt that it was an articulation of something that I sensed a lot of them felt, came from a Russian oligarch, a man called Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And I spoke to him. He is now in jail. But when I spoke to him, and when he made this comment, it was 1998. He was the richest man in Russia. And the Russian ruble had just defaulted and devalued. The guy, he had lost a lot of money. He was mostly an oil baron, but he also owned a bank and had lost a lot of money in his bank. And he was sort of angry at himself because he had put a person who wasn't an oligarch in charge of his bank, and the guy had made mistakes leading to the loss of hundreds of millions of dollars. And how he put it to me was, he said, look, it's my own fault. I should never have trusted the guy. And the reason he felt he shouldn't have trusted the guy with running the business was simply that he was not an oligarch. And as Khodorkovsky put it to me, if a man is not an oligarch, something is not right with him. Mm. We all had the same chances, and some of us succeeded, and some of us did not. And I did sort of catch an undercurrent of that feeling in a lot of these guys that, you know, I made it myself, you didn't. At some level, you know, frankly, I'm just better than you.
Right. I mean, it was interesting, you know, like during the campaign, not to keep bringing it back to Romney, but, you know, to a certain extent, in many cases unwittingly, laid it all out there. But during that sort of that famous talk that he was giving to his to potential donors, when he was talking about the 47%, there was an exchange in there, or a part of what he said that I think got very little coverage, which was that. You know, if his grandfather, I think it was, or his father, had taken a Mexican name, or had taken it from his wife or his grandmother, I can't remember exactly what it was, that Romney would probably be winning right now, and it belied a certain sort of like ignorance as to how the advantages or just the luck that was involved in him getting there. Because if Romney's last name, of course, was Latino, chances are he would not have been the Republican nominee. I would put those chances at about 100%. And so the idea that he would be in the lead of that race sort of belies all the things that allowed him to get to where he was. And to a certain extent, I think there's this that same attitude seems to permeate these plutocrats, because they have, I mean, it's interesting, you know, back, I think, to that New Yorker piece where you were talking about the sense of victimization that these plutocrats had, because in some ways, basically, President Obama had hurt their feelings by not from a policy standpoint, but just not acknowledging in some ways their superiority.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, when that Romney comment about the 47%, when that came out, I actually felt really sorry for Romney. And I felt sorry for him because it wasn't some bizarre sentiment he was expressing. For that class, that was absolutely a truth universally acknowledged. And I quote in my book, and, you know, this was published before Romney's comments went public. Mm-hmm. So I talked to these people around the time Romney was making these private comments, but months before they became part of the political debate. Several people saying almost identical things. The only funny thing was they didn't agree on what exactly the percentage was. So one guy said it's 46% who are the takers, and another guy said it was 50%, and another guy said it was 40%. But there was, you know, very much this sense of, you know, as sometimes it was described, you know, the makers versus the takers. One person who I interviewed, Foster Freeze, and he is, you know, he's an extreme example. He is severely conservative, as he would put it. He was the guy who funded the super PAC that gave Rick Santorum that big boost during the primaries. But Freeze talked to me. He was he put it at 46% of Americans not paying taxes. And he also said, you know, actually that, you know, people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, they shouldn't pay taxes at all. The government should pay them because they have done such great things. And he actually went on to say, and this is very close to the direct quote, he said, you know, poor people haven't created any jobs. Only Bill Gates has created jobs. We should honor and uplift the 1%. And the idea being, you know, exactly as you were saying, Sam, that there's this sense of wanting to be honored, respected, feeling worthy of that. And I think that it's, you know, it's a non-trivial point. I mean, at some level, it is quite shocking. And I didn't even realize how shocking it was until I sort of left 1% land where I had been for my reporting and started talking to normal people about it, and, you know, their jaws would drop. But, you know, this sense of victimization was extreme. To give you a couple of quick examples, you know, there's one guy, hedge fund guy, young guy, multimillionaire, billionaire, you know, depending on how he's doing that year, someone who supported Obama in 2008, pretty liberal guy. And in 2010, he sent out an email whose subject heading was Battered Wives. And it's written in very graphic language in the voice, the first person voice of a woman who is being beaten. It includes lines like, he usually doesn't hit me where it shows. He usually doesn't mean it. He makes it up to me, that sort of thing. And the abusive spouse, you know, meeting out these physical beatings is the president, Barack Obama. And the person being beaten, you know, in the conceit of this email was the hedge fund guy and his comrades. So just think about that for a minute. Here you are, like, it's hard for me to imagine a more privileged person than a wealthy young hedge fund guy in New York. And yet in his self-conception, he is comparing himself to one of the most powerless people in our society, a woman who is being beaten by her husband. Another example, you know, I don't want you to think I'm picking on Wall Street. Another example of this, and this was sort of an on-the-record, on-video interview with a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, multimillionaire, both a very successful investor and a founder of successful technology technology companies, and he said that the rich have become a persecuted minority in America. And, you know, to be rich now feels very much like being a member of an ill-treated ethnic minority. And that's something that the president should feel particularly guilty of, because after all, he knows what it's like. So, you know, an extreme and very emotionally expressed sense of victimization. And yet, you know, what was also interesting to me is it's not at some level, you know, this isn't, it's not a trivial thing. A really interesting, you know, also as it happens, plutocrat, but someone who writes about them as well is a guy called Nick Hanauer.
I've interviewed him. He did his piece, TED Talk, that got some controversy, I think.
Right. So Nick has offered me the best explanation of what's going on. And what he said to me was, you know, the reason you have this intense hostility is because, in a way, Barack Obama and not just Obama, but this entire, any sort of critique of income inequality, any sense that the way the U.S. economy is working today doesn't work for the middle class, you know, Hanauer says, you know, that is an existential threat to the super rich. And what he says, and I find this to be an absolutely believable, accurate explanation of the thinking, is that really since Reagan, there's been this, you know, if you are a rich person, wonderful equation of civic virtue with wealth, self-made, with money that you earn. And, you know, a belief that, you know, the size of your bank balance was also a measure of your contribution to society.
And your moral standing in some,
right. You know, your virtue, it was a measure of your virtue. And as Hanauer says, isn't that great? Like, imagine how wonderful that would be, you know, without even setting aside the philanthropy, just being a job creator, right? The Foster Freeze thing. Poor people don't create any jobs, only Bill Gates does. So just the fact of pursuing your own commercial self-interest successfully makes you a good person. And if all of a sudden you have a social critique, which actually doesn't say you're a bad person, it doesn't say that, but it suggests that maybe there are at least some forms of money-making activity which can be good for the person who's making the money, but may not automatically be good for everybody else. That actually is a very profound ideological and indeed even moral challenge.
And I would imagine, too, that it also cuts at sort of like some deep personality issue. And without getting, you know, obviously, you know, getting too sort of psychological about this, but you've got these plutocrats who are telling you, like, I know stewardesses better than I know my wife. You know, I only see my wife on the weekends. You know, I presumably they don't see their kids, you know, any more than they see their wives in some respects. And that
one of the CEO guys, he didn't say this to me, but one of leading CEOs, you would know his name, but I can't say because that would be not fair.
I understand.
But someone who's on the board of this leading CEO told me that the guy, it's a man, they're almost all men, for some important milestone in the life of his daughter, went on a 2-week trip with her to Kilimanjaro. And this was, you know, an adult child or, you know, college-age child. And that was the longest period of time he had ever spent with the child.
Wow.
Just think about that, right? I know you're a parent, Sam. I am, too.
Well, you had
never spent a full 2 weeks with your kid,
you know,
and they're in college.
I mean, I would imagine that, like, on some level, if money is virtue to them, and they are... Well, I would think there's two parts about any type of rhetoric that challenges that necessarily then starts to implicate their relationships with their kids or with their wives, because they have supplanted whatever sort of, you know, I get self-satisfaction I get from saying, you know, I'm a good dad. You know, I have a relationship.
It makes you ask, was it worth it? Right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's one thing to do all of that. And look, I mean, let's not, you know, downplay. I know a lot of people have asked me, well, you know, are they really happy? And everyone sort of wants me to say, no, they're not happy at all. I'd actually say a lot of them are extremely happy.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
I would imagine.
These are people who
That's not
are
hard for me to imagine.
Incredibly talented at the thing that they do. They're really, really good at it. And it's usually really fun to do the thing you're really good at.
It's also nice to not to operate in life without having any constraints financially. I mean,
exactly.
It's impossible
for
you to imagine.
You know, they have no financial insecurity. I mean, they have tons of business insecurity. They're always being challenged. They're always worried about losing. But they're never worried about, you know, am I going to be able to put food on the table or to have a more, you know, ordinary middle class concern? Let's
send
even
my kid
set
to
aside,
college,
you know,
maintain five houses,
to pay for
whatever
college
it is.
For my
right.
kids? You know, am I going to be able to make the mortgage payments this month? Those are not worries they ever have to have. And, you know, it's very restful and lovely not to have those worries. So, you know, I don't think they're unhappy. I think a lot of them kind of love their jobs. But I totally agree with you. I think there is an added pleasure in being lionized by your society. And, you know, if there comes a moment when you don't love your job so much or you can't spend that time with your kid, being able to say to yourself, to your kid, having the social support which says, well, you know, dad is doing something really important, not just to make another 10 or 20 million, but it's good for the world.
Right. I mean, I imagine President Obama spends less time with his kids now that he's president than he would otherwise be. But, you know, you basically say, well, dad's president. And
right. You would have to be a pretty shocking kid to resent that, right?
Well, I mean, you may or may not resent it, but at least from his perspective, he can justify it to himself. You know, who knows how a kid's going to react, but it's easy for him to justify it to himself, I would imagine, on some level. He's like, look, I'm president. Somebody's got to do this, and so it's me. But do you think, let me ask you this question, and this may be a hard question to answer, but I wonder if the president obviously is one of the few people, and I would imagine certain officials in our government, maybe senators to a certain extent, but maybe less so, who can operate in those circles and be perceived as someone who is, you know, obviously they look down upon him because these plutocrats, because he's never held a job or whatever it is they say. But it's pretty hard to argue that this isn't an extremely powerful person who has an immense amount of stature in the world. Do you think that, for instance, if President Obama had been of that class in terms of maybe not billions, but had come from a more a wealthy, whether it was old money or relatively new money, and was chastising them in the same way, do you think that they would have the same level of victimization? In other words, like, not only is President Obama, and again, this is just rhetorical, I mean, because I think these guys have done very well under President Obama's policies, not only is President Obama sort of rhetorically hurting our sense of self-virtue, but he's got no business to even comment on this because he doesn't even know what it's like to have this kind of money.
Yeah, I think their attitude towards Obama is complicated. I think on one hand, as you've just said, a lot of them do feel disdainful on the grounds that he has no business experience. I think that knock against him will have been significantly undermined by his technical victory over Romney, if you will, in 2012. You know, if the point about business is being an extremely, extremely proficient master of whatever technical task you have set yourself, you know, the fact that the Obama campaign was better at technology and voter turnout than Romney is really, really significant. And in some ways, you know, very much undermines that notion of, you know, useless community organizer. But that is one part of it. You know, he's never had to worry about can he pay the salaries at the end of the month.
All right. Chris, let me ask you one more quick question. I'm sorry. How do you get these guys to keep talking to you? Then one of my, I've got people anticipating my speaking to you. I wonder, like, do they not realize, like, that you're shining a light on them and they don't look so good? Or how do you maintain your access when to at least us, you're exposing something about them that's not terribly attractive.
So I think part of it is that what may seem really shocking to you might not be so shocking to them.
Right.
You know, they think they're right. I think another part is that people love to talk about themselves, and once they start talking, they have a hard time stopping.
Mm-hmm.
I think another part is, and I do think this is really crucial, and, you know, this was a very important thing for me to emphasize in my book. This is not an anti-capitalist book.
Right.
I am a real believer in capitalism. I am a believer in the technology revolution. I am a believer in globalization. And I don't think the plutocrats, by definition, are bad. You know, I think that, you know, I think many, not all, but I think many are job creators. And I think whether they are job creators or not, I think that they are part, you know, one you know, their rise is one consequence of these largely benign economic forces. The points that I make are that the other side of that coin is the hollowing out of the middle class, which I think is, you know, the most devastating political economic reality of our time. And I worry about this social and political distance between the plutocrats and everybody else that you and I have been talking about, Sam, and I worry about its impact on, you know, our future politics. So that's not, you know, this, that's hardly, I don't know, a Leninist take on the plutocrats. And, you know, in my view anyway, the very smartest, most thoughtful of them share these concerns.
Right.
I actually have had several people, you know, in the billionaire set who I didn't know before my book was published, who have called me up and, you know, invited me to tea and wanted to talk to me. And, you know, their point has been, we think you are completely right. If we don't do something about this, there will be a revolution. And do you have any ideas on how to turn back the tide? And I sort of said, well, why do you care? I mean, you're winning right now. And what they have said is, precisely, we are the people who are winning from the current system. We have the most at stake. And so it should be most in our interest to do something about it. And the truth is, actually, you know, the last time things got so out of whack was the 20s and 30s. And both the American elites and ultimately the Western European ones, you know, somewhat having their hand forced by communist revolutions in Russia and China, the Great Depression and the Second World War, but nonetheless, they made major, major accommodations in favor of the middle class, you know, to prevent going the way of Russia and China. So, you know, plutocrats can make smart compromises with the rest of us.
Interesting. Christopher Eland, author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Pleasure talking to you, Sam, as ever.